of research. So that, in this sense, it's a very real problem, and not just intellectual persiflage that I'm engaging in here this evening. When it comes to the time factor, I think we're all exposed to the idea that many persons think there's a difference between the social sciences and the humanities, in that there is a timeliness about the work of the social scientist. You have there's the rough idea abroad that a political scientist or psychologist or an economist, for example, is generally concerned with the here and now. At least the laity tend to have this idea, and I suspect that within the academic world you'd find evidence of it as well. And there is then the feeling also that the social sciences, because they are timely, concerned with present problems and present issues, are therefore more practical. And in that sense, in the practical society, more deserving of support. Well, there may well be some justification to this view if we interpret it correctly, in that many practitioners in the fields of the social sciences, though by no means all, and I would insist upon that, have been trying manfully in the last decade to apply certain methods taken over from the natural sciences to social phenomena. Obviously is one of the major trends in some of these social science fields. In some cases, there has been more talk about doing it than success in evolving the actual methods for doing it, but nonetheless, an earnest effort is being made to apply so-called scientific methods to the social behavior of man. This means that they've tried to adopt for social problems laboratory methods, testing methods of the sciences, and applying them to social problems. If you want to test reactions, it's obvious that it's easier to do this with live human beings than with dead human beings. And that, I would submit, is not as a more important fact than it might seem at first utterance. This is not just being facetious. But if you are attempting to apply a method where you test the reaction of the guinea pig, it's easier to apply the test to living specimens of Homo sapiens than to dead ones. And the result is that certain techniques, certain research approaches, are applicable when you're dealing with live human beings and will lead to results which have become impossible when you're dealing with an older generation of mankind. You can develop your polling techniques, your controlled interview methods, various kinds of aptitude tests, responses to standard questionnaires, and so on. And there certainly is every reason to believe that the methodologies involved here can be constantly improved and that they will produce useful results. But they do require the live human guinea pigs. And the result is that they would appear, the men who are applying these methods, obviously to be concerned with the present. Inevitably, it's the live response today that they are testing. And the result is that this kind of a study of man, requiring special techniques and methods, and requiring, for example, more mathematics than the average humanist bothers to acquire, may also attract individuals who have aptitudes that are somewhat different from the aptitudes of persons who use other kinds of methods for studying man. The result is that this kind of approach appeals to a certain kind of scholar endowed with certain aptitudes. In contrast, then, to the social scientists who can operate with methodologies that require the analysis of living men, you have the humanists, who conventionally are regarded as being preoccupied primarily with the past. And I think all of us who have practiced as humanists are aware of the fact that the remark that's often made about us is that we're concerned with things that are over and done with. They deal with what man has done. Now, actually, what the humanist works with is something I don't quite know that this is the right terminology, and we've got some philosophers here who may straighten me out on this and help me. But in order to indicate what I mean, I've said that the humanist tends to use evidence that, in a sense, is objectified, evidence into which there has been inserted an imprint of human experience in some form. He deals with an art object, which is, in fact, an artifact, something that has been made by man. He deals with a poem, or with a novel, or with a theological tractate. It may be an historical chronicle. It may be legal transactions buried in the archives somewhere. But it may be some other type of historical record. But in each instance, the evidence that is being used, in a certain sense, is finished. It has acquired a physical form. It is an object. Now, from these objects, the humanist infers a variety of things about the human beings who produced those objects. And he reads, in other words, something about the nature of mankind, the aspirations and the attempts and the wishes and the events of man from a look at this kind of evidence. And I think we're all aware of the fact that there are, in fact, an infinite number of special skills which have to be developed in order to deal with evidence of these varying kinds, from the work of the paleographer or the archaeologist on up to the literary textual critic, and all of the other galaxy of skills that are required to extract meaning out of these objects which bear the imprint of human action. Now, obviously, this method, then, that can be applied to evidence of this kind, could just as well be applied to a poem that was written this morning as to one that was written 2,000 years ago. But in the case of a poet who happens still to be living, if you're worried about what he really meant, perhaps if you're a new critic, you don't have to worry about the poet. The poem stands by itself, and you let it go at that. But if you have any historical interest or any concern with deriving from the poet what he meant by this poem, you have, in addition to the object itself that you can study, some possibility of talking with him about his meaning. And for that reason, I suppose, universities have the habit of bringing living poets to the campus, as well as having students study the actual printed version of their writing. This means, then, in other words, that the dead past, whether it be dear or otherwise, is the peculiar province of the humanist, who has to have a variety of special skills in order to be able to interpret and to read these objects that constitute his evidence. And for that reason, various temperaments different from those of the social scientists not infrequently develop, and we see specialists who lean one way or the other. Now, I may have labored this point, but I think it's actually very important in determining the difference between a humanistic kind of approach to the study of man and a social or scientific approach to the study of man. There are certain additional consequences which flow from looking at the methodologies and the kinds of evidence that can be used here. It sometimes is asserted almost militantly, and this, I assure you, as you see, is not ultimately a speech against the social sciences. Sometimes asserted that social science is a science. That word is very strongly emphasized. A multitude of hopes are sometimes built on that word. I think the best evidence of that are the aspirations of many social scientists at the National Science Foundation will turn out to be a support for them in their work. They may be right, because there are those who would like to force the interpretation of the Charter of the National Science Foundation broadly, but certainly any ordinary semantic exercise in reading the language of the bill would suggest that the persons who wrote the bill had in mind primarily what we conventionally think of as the natural sciences. By a kind of extrapolation, people are trying to push over into the social science field as well. Once in a while, when I hear this assertion, the social sciences are scientific, I end up wondering if they think there's no rationality involved at all in the processes of the humanist who deals with somewhat different types of materials as he attacks his problems. Well, now, I think this leads to the fact that many a social scientist is concerned with the predictive element. He's trying to find out how to predict what is likely to happen. And it's a little easier to do that, again, when you're dealing with live human beings than when you're going over the experience of men in the past as recorded by various other kinds of evidence. There is, then, in the social sciences, an emphasis on this predictive effort. Men like to formulate problems as hypotheses which will work out in human experiences. They like to formulate this by saying that if X is the particular condition, then Y is likely to result, and there's a certain statistical chance that Y will result. Now, I think there are those who are concerned with the predictive possibilities of the social sciences like to formulate their problems that way. And there's no reason on earth why people shouldn't like that kind of thing, formulate problems that way, but I think that tends to be somewhat characteristic of some of the social scientists. Now, this leads to the idea that the social scientists will end up giving us ways of controlling man comparable to those discovered by the natural scientists with reference to nature. Obviously, the humanities don't tend to follow in this direction. They'll fall at the other end of the range here now. The humanities are far more purely descriptive. It's an effort to state not if X, then Y, it's just what is X. In that sense, to concentrate on describing as best they can what happened. X probably developed in this form because of the interaction of the following factors. The mechanics of this can't be worked out very exactly, but our best guess is that this is probably what happened. And most humanistic formulations, I think, tend to take that shape. Well, another distinguishing feature here, I think, in the difference between the two approaches is that concerned with ends or goals. The social scientist, striving to deal with variables under controlled conditions, is greatly concerned with these mechanisms in society and with how changes can be effected. He makes every effort to be objective, to stay out of the facts himself as best he can, to be, so to speak, scientifically sanitary. Washes his hands very carefully before he approaches the problem so that he instills nothing in the way of a judgment into it. And if you allow a value judgment to creep in, that's proof of malpractice as far as the specialist is concerned. Now, obviously, there's an increasing interest among the social science fields in this problem of ends or goals. But there does tend to be this feeling that you keep your ends out as you concentrate on this analysis of the process. The humanist, on the other hand, tends to show much more concern with the problem of whether why is ultimately a better objective, so the problem of ends. And I think that's a natural consequence of his leafing through the pages of the past, seeing the different goals, the different aspirations which men have set for themselves, and the different forms that they've developed in culture for trying to satisfy those goals. In looking at what men have done in other times and places, you're led almost automatically to raise the question of whether this is a preferable end to that end over there. Is this the choice which should be preferred? What are the preferred ends for the life of man? Finally, the social scientist and his methodology, this remark is often made, and I think there's some truth in it, is not so much concerned with the individual case. By the very methodological approach that he uses, the kinds of questions he asks, he tends to wipe out the visage of the individual in the search for types. He seeks similarities or uniformities and tries to isolate out individuality as he gets at a trend, a tendency, at some kind of uniformity. And there's no question what this provides some very useful insight into human behavior and into the knowledge of mankind. But the objective of this kind of work tends to be a set of abstractions. Well, a humanist, by virtue of the very kinds of materials that he has to deal with, tends, on the contrary, to deal with the individual case. Even if he's interpreting Greek civilization now, it has to be pretty largely in terms of Thucydides' history or the poetry of Sappho, or the statue made by some nameless Greek artist. The subject matter has indelibly stamped upon it something that can't be escaped: time, place, individuality, personality. And so he tends to think in terms of integration of these things into some kind of a whole. Well, now, since the humanist deals so much with the individual, he's led toward a greater concern, perhaps, ultimately, with the problem of pulling these things together into some kind of an integration. This man isn't a political man or an economic man or an aesthetic man or a religious man. He's a whole man who has who exemplifies certain common characteristics, perhaps, who is colored by his own personal eccentricities. Well, now, so much for suggesting a series of ranges by which we might try to make a distinction between the humanistic approach and the social science approach.